please to either turn your phones off or put them on buzz. Helps the meeting move along. I plan on taking breaks every 90 minutes if possible, or as close to it as possible. So if you need to make calls or return calls or do anything else, please try to time it with a break, which, as I said, I'll try to take every 90 minutes. Full participation is your responsibility. Thank you. I'm going to move right into reports and recent activities. Actually, first, before I do that, does anyone have any additions or suggested changes to the agenda as laid out? Okay, we'll move right into reports, recent activities. Give you a brief overview of the executive committee meeting that we had back on May 25th. You recall one of the motions made at the last council meeting was to consider appointing a small technical working group to evaluate the potential impacts of implementing, which was at the time, a proposed groundfish buyout. The executive committee reviewed this, and since the motion was made and when the executive committee met, the buyout committee no longer functioned as a body. That was one of the considerations of the executive committee. The second was the fact that this issue was not above the line, if you will, when we set priorities. And the third, and probably the most important issue, was the lack of resources to dedicate to doing this type of evaluation. Additionally, staff indicated it would be very difficult to actually conduct this analysis without any information, that type of information we're waiting for from GARM 3. So all those factors went into the executive committee's recommendation not to establish a body to do some analysis on the buyout. The next issue we discussed was the composition of scallop advisory panels. Currently we have an advisory panel for the general category, which was put together for Amendment 11, and then we had our longstanding scallop advisory panel, which consisted of some general category members and limited access members. The recommendation from the executive committee is to go back to one group after Amendment 11 is complete, attempting to strike a balance of around 5 general category members and 10 limited access members. Additionally, the executive committee recommended that prior to asking a member to serve on an AP, that we send the list to NOAA General Counsel and ask them to review whether or not any of the AP hopefuls have in the past 3 years have any significant violations, fishery conservation violations. We also talked about the budget, which seems to be something we talk a lot about. At the council chairs meeting in New Orleans, we ended up getting an additional $146,000. We shared that up with other councils. There was about $1 million that was shared across all 8 regional councils. Our take or our share was about $146,000. So staff and Paul Howard put together a proposal on how to spend that money. So that money, the proposal is to spend that money funding U.S.-Canada meetings, as well as hiring an additional staff person on a 2-year contract to assist in the development of Amendment 16 and sectors. We also, in that discussion, highlighted the fact that we may need to develop 3-year specs for red crab, and that we may need to react to the ad hoc monkfish stock assessment, which is happening in July. We also talked about delaying the whiting amendment pending a recharacterization of data. Apparently there's some confusion over where landings can be attributed to, whether the northern or southern area. I think we'll get into that a little more under the Pelagics Committee report. And we also talked about continuing with the sector omnibus amendment and keeping herring below the priority line, as agreed to last fall. Let's see. We also recommend that monkfish and skates be separated immediately from the current combined committee, which is part of the multi-species committee, and be handled by staff and PDT. the executive director and staff have identified shortfalls in the skate PDT and have, I believe there's a letter in our binder which talks about the need for another fisheries analyst and, I believe, an economist to complement that PDT. We talked about sector formation requests for 2008 implementation and their impact on Amendment 16 development. The executive committee felt that we didn't have the time or the resources to initiate a framework between now and 2008. We'll get into that issue again during the groundfish discussion on Thursday. Membership and function of the SSC. The executive committee reviewed staff comments related to the role of the SSC under the new MSA and agreed, dependent on resources, to adopt the recommendations with exception of number 8. That's enclosure number 4 in your binder. I believe we're going to need to have a motion to that effect. We reviewed the first draft of the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council report, which is entitled Council Management Coordination. This was part of the Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization. There was a requirement that the Mid-Atlantic, in coordination with the New England Council, draft a report on council liaison process and how we co-manage or jointly manage plans. That's enclosure 5. Then we changed or recommended to change some meeting dates for 2008 in order to address concerns with multi-species issues and the timing of GARM 3. Essentially what we've done is move the June council meeting to an earlier date and then move the what was the September council meeting to, I believe it's the first week in October, so that we can get an extra week or two to look at the GARM results. The Mid-Atlantic had requested mackerel advisors. We read the letter that they provided to us. We didn't object to them having Mid-Atlantic, having squid, mackerel, and butterfish advisors from the New England area. And then the last issue we discussed was the issue of an ITQ referendum. The Magnuson Act requires that a referendum happen in New England if the council proposes an ITQ program. So the how a referendum process will work, NIMS is charged with developing that, and there's the next agenda item will deal with that as well. Any questions? Paul.
Just on the executive committee looking at other ways of doing business and looking at disbanding some committees and having it addressed by staff and PDT and full council, it's primarily a budget concern and efficiency concern. However, at the next council meeting in September, there were a number of questions about, well, who's going to task the PDT and staff? Will it be full council? Will it be executive committee? Who's going to task the advisors to take action? Should it be executive committee without a species committee? Should there be members of the council on you know, as part of a small group? And so there's a number of issues that I'll have a decision document white paper at the September council meeting for how to do business without a species committee. The other thing is the executive committee recommended that monkfish and skates be separated immediately. In other words, no committees for monkfish or skates. The monkfish one is problematic, and we've discussed that. That really doesn't work because it's a joint plan, and we really need to have the joint committee with the Mid-Atlantic be looking at monkfish. But skates is one where we ought to consider just having the skate PDT bring the skate FMP measures and everything directly to the full council. So what I would recommend, Mr. Chairman, is that the council do some type of motion or consensus on number 2 so that we have some direction on how to address the scallop advisory panels when we do that in this summer, the end of this summer, for new 3-year terms. Number 2 would probably need a motion. And also, how to do business differently, do you want me to develop a white paper for June? So that would be number three. And number seven, probably need motions so that the council can agree to have the staff take action and then bring it back to the council in September for final vote.
Okay. Everybody's on number one, behind tab number one. Number two is the issue of combining the two scallop APs into one AP after Amendment 11. Does anyone want to make a motion to that effect? Dave Simpson.
Yeah, I would move contingent on passage of Amendment 11 that we combine the two APs into a single AP with about five general category and 10 limited access vessels.
Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Rip Cunningham. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Anyone opposed? Anyone abstain? One abstention. The motion carries. Okay. Number three.
Have me develop a white paper on doing business differently for voting September council meeting.
This was the issue. This was the issue about how to handle committees in the future. Some committees, the executive committee has recommended are disbanded. I think it would probably be best if we asked Paul and staff to develop a white paper to be reviewed in September to review the pros and cons of taking this course of action. So unless there's any objection, I'll just ask him to do that. Any objection? Okay. And number seven, I'm not sure whether or not the council's had a chance to review enclosure four on how to function with the SSC under the new requirements of the Magnuson Act. You want some time to review those recommendations before we take action on it? Yes, okay. So I'll come back to that before we break this week. Paul.
I could develop this into a standard operating procedure like we have now. We have a SOPs for how our SSC operates. So what I could do is develop a SOP for approval at the next council meeting that would include all these things so that folks would have ample time to look at this, provide me feedback, and I'll develop a SOP for next council meeting to vote on. Of one critical aspect that the executive committee didn't agree to that the staff continues to support is that our SSC, right now we have an SSC and an SSAC, and we don't have a Habitat PhD type review panel. So what staff is recommending is that we have a SSC that incorporates population dynamic type folks, the PopDi scientists, has three members from our SSAC and maybe disband the SSAC and have three ecologists to review any habitat and ecosystem information so that we'd have one body with habitat folks, ecosystem folks combined, economists, sociologists, and PopDi folks rather than have three bodies. And the executive committee was not in favor of that. So, I don't know if you want to have a little bit of a discussion there, but having three bodies is a little cumbersome. All the other councils have one SSC, and I think there are a lot of benefits to having everyone together as we move towards ecosystem management.
Anybody want to further discuss that issue, or would you just like Paul to put together another white paper? He wants to do a lot of work this summer for our review this September. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I support having him produce a standard operating procedure manual. I would like to see addressed in that how we're going to accommodate differing scientific viewpoints, specifically you know, what to do in the case where the committee is split, or to guarantee representation of a wide set of scientific views. I would like to see that. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, Paul, looks like you're busy this summer. Okay, that concludes my report. Okay, Paul, you're next.
Just a couple things briefly, Mr. Chairman. We've gone out with the $146,000 from the service additional funding to assist with groundfish in U.S. Canada. We've gone out with a solicitation for a new staff member for on a two-year contract. And if anyone knows of any talented individuals that want to work with us for 2 years on groundfish and U.S. Canada issues, I think we've got a solicitation open on our webpage and a number of places for a two-year contract. And we're asking that people get their CVs and applications in by the middle of June. So hopefully by the end of the summer, we'll have a person on board for 2 years. Additionally, Pat and the service has agreed to give us $75,000 additional funding to address limited access privilege programs, LAPS. So we'll be putting together a solicitation on that, too, to address additional one-year contract person and some additional meetings to better address sectors and IFQs and things like that. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Paul? Okay. Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see. On May 9th and May 10th, we published the final rules implementing the 2007 operations plan and agreement for the Georgia's Bank Hook sector and Georgia's Bank Cod fixed gear sectors, respectively. For the 2007 fishing year, the Georgia's Bank Cod hook sector was allocated 8.02% of the Georgia's Bank Cod total allowable catch, or about 675 metric tons. While the Georgia's Bank Cod fixed gear sector was allocated 9.16% of the Georgia's Bank Cod TAC, or 771.1 metric tons. Final rule was published in the Federal Register on May 7th to implement the hard tax for cod haddock and yellowtail flounder in the U.S.-Canada management area. Let's see. The cod TAC was set at 494 metric tons, 6,270 metric tons of haddock, and 900 metric tons of yellowtail. Summary of the days at sea leasing program through June 18th, May 1 of this year through June 18th, there were 63 leases processed. Of those, 60 of them were approved. Total days at sea leased, 2,099.46. Average cost of the lease, $527.58. An interim rule extension was published in the Federal Register on May 31st for the 2007 fishing year for the Elephant Trunk Scallop Access Area. The extension is effective from June 21st through December 23rd. The extension maintains the trip allocations and restriction on deck loading that were included in the December 2006 interim rule. Amendment 13, the final rule for Amendment 13 to the Atlantic Scallop FMP was published in the Federal Register on June 13th and effective on June 12th. This action permanently reactivates the industry-funded observer program for the scallop fishery. Let's see. We extended the emergency action on summer flounder to maintain the total allowable landings or the quota of 17.112 million pounds until the end of this fishing year, which ends on December 31st. That was published on June 14th and will be effective on June 18th. Let's see. A notice of availability for Amendment 14 to the Summer Flounder, Scup, and Black Sea Bass Fishery Management Plan published in the Federal Register on April 11th. The notice of availability comment period closed on June 11th. The proposed rule for Amendment 14 published on April 24th, and the comment period closed on May 24th with no comments received. This is the final rule that would implement a rebuilding plan for Scup. On May 25th, we received a letter from the Food and Drug Administration, which requested the continuation of a temporary rule that closed certain federal waters to the harvest of bivalve shellfish, with the exception of sea scallop abductor mussels harvested and shucked at sea due to the presence of toxins that cause PSP. The letter is under review. A temporary PSP closure area was first implemented on June 16, 2005, and is due to expire if it's not modified on June 30th. So that closure will likely be extended. I'll try to cut this short. let's see. And then I just wanted to talk briefly about herring and the herring tack. As you may have heard, the herring tack for the period one portion of the 1A fishery was exceeded by quite a bit this year. As you know, the Area 1 tack is allocated into two portions, 5,000 metric tons allocated for the period January through May, and 45,000 metric tons allocated to period 2, June through December. We had a situation this year where landings had been fairly low through the first, I guess it's about the first 20 weeks of the year, which would be ending on May 22nd. In the 21st week of the year, the industry landed approximately 50% in that 1 week of the total tack. Landings increased significantly. That was the week ending May 29th. So by the time we knew that 50% of the landings had been taken in 1 week, of course, we were already into the following reporting week where another 50% of the quota was taken. And at this point, we're not entirely sure how much that 5,000 metric ton period one portion of the quota was exceeded because we still need one of the weeks spanned both May and June, and we need to separate out the June landings to tell for sure. It's quite a bit over the 5,000 metric tons, and frankly, I'm not sure what we could possibly have done about it given the way the landings occurred, as I said, 50% in the 1 week, and then we're halfway through the next week before we know the 50% was landed in that 1 week, and then, of course, it was the end of May. At that point, in fact, the second week report wasn't available to us until May 30th. This is a quota that we've monitored in cooperation with Maine DMR. As a result of this, and clearly the need to do this differently and find a different way to monitor this, we're going to take over full responsibility of monitoring that quota within the regional office in Gloucester. Not anything that Maine DMR, not anything about how it was monitored or anything about how Maine DMR was conducting some of this monitoring. We just need to find a different way to do this given the way the landings occurred. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Pat. Any questions for Pat? Bill Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Pat. On the herring issue, I can understand the problem of it happening. I guess the first question would that bounces at me was, is there any major biological impact of overshooting that quota in that time period that you really have to be worried about? And the second one I'd just like to point out, in the herring fishery now, and I mean, I understand you're going to take over the reporting, but right now in the herring fishery, a herring boat first has to declare, if it's in a VMS fishery, has to declare into the fishery on the VMS. Then, let's see how this goes. Then when he's fishing, then he's got to call for the observer, then he can go fishing. Then when he's fishing, at the end of the day, he's got to report what he's going to land and where he's going to land it. At the end of the day, he's got to send in a VTR, and now he still has to call in on the IVR. That's, you know, five actions already that that boat has to take every day it goes fishing. So I hope you keep that in mind when you're trying to streamline that process.
Mike Leary.
Just a question of monitoring for Pat. Are they reporting, are the herring boats reporting weekly or are they reporting daily through the VMS?
First to Phil's first question, and which I'm glad you asked because I meant to mention that. Fortunately, since this is just a portion of the overall TAC for this year, there's no real biological impact. It's just a question of, I think that originally the council had requested these be split into the two portions to allow the quota to last longer into the fall. And so that's the only real impact, I think. To Mike's question, they're reporting through the IVR, and it's weekly. So, for example, the first week 22, which is the week ending May 26th, they are required to report by May 29th. So that was the week where 50% of the quota had been landed in that 1 week. So, as I said, we knew then on May 30th, but by then it closes anyway on May 31st.
Anyone else for Pat? Dr. Pierce.
It's a point, not so much a question, and it's, again, with regards to sea herring, and I completely understand the problems that you had with monitoring the landings of the herring, but I do need to bring to your attention that because we did have the overage, it will have implications for how the states deal with some of our own specific restrictions on the sea herring fishery, such as days out of the fishery, because it relates to percent of overall TAC taken. I suspect, therefore, that once you get the final numbers and you know the extent to which we are over, Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts in particular, we'll have to take another look at what we're doing this year, and hopefully we won't need to make any changes for this year. We might, but I just wanted to highlight that there is an implication of the overage of hard TAC management for sea herring, and that relates to how states do business with the industry.
Anyone else? Okay. Thanks, Pat. I don't believe we have general counsel here. Okay. So the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, I wanted to apologize. I didn't introduce Dr. Nancy Thompson, who's the new director of the Science Center down in Woods Hole. She's seated here next to Pat Kirkle. So make sure you take a moment over the next couple of days to introduce yourself and have a conversation. And we also have Jim Weinberg from the Science Center. Nancy, did you want to say anything?
Well, no. Obviously, I'm sorry I've missed a couple of meetings. This is the first one I've been able to attend. If you don't know who I am, I came up from the Southeast Fisheries Science Center, where I was the director there for about 5 years, I think, five, maybe 6 years. Spent the summer in Silver Spring as the director of science and technology. And then when John Borman decided that he wanted that position, which was good for me, the position up here became available, and since I had spent my entire career down in Miami, I decided that it would be worthwhile to come up here. And quite frankly, I'm not from New England, but my family is all from New York and Boston. So It was kind of nice coming back here. So anyway, just to let you know that I'm here. I've been here since November. Planning to stick around for a while. And if you're going to ask me to do the report, I'm not going to be able to do that yet. I'll defer to Jim, but I'm sure there will be plenty of opportunities for me to do that in the future. But anyway, I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks, Nancy. Jim?
Thank you. And now for the rest of the story. I'll start with talking about surveys and then go into stock assessment meetings. First of all, the spring bottom trawl survey with the albatross was conducted from March the 7th to April the 28th, 2007. And in addition to the random stations that they do, they added additional random stations to target areas where they suspected there would be concentrations of scup and black sea bass and George's Bank yellowtail flounder. And by adding additional random stations to certain strata, it allows us to get a much more precise estimate of the abundance of fish in those strata. The sea scallop survey will be conducted from July the 9th to August the 16th. And there are two scallop research set-aside projects that are closely coordinated with the transition of the survey from the Albatross 4 to an alternate vessel platform. The plan for the scallop survey it'll be conducted this summer with the Albatross, and then in 2008, the Albatross will again do the survey, but we plan to have it shadowed by a UNOLS vessel. And then in 2009, the plan is to have the UNOLS vessel do the survey. And there's plan B there is if we can't have a UNOLS vessel to possibly have a commercial vessel doing the scallop survey. But plan A is to go with a UNOLS vessel. And these are the ships that are part of the fleet that's used for research in the United States. The Northern Shrimp Bottom Trawl Survey will be conducted from mid-July to mid-August. Then moving on to news of the new research vessel, the Henry Bigelow. We talked about getting that vessel for a long time. Now we have it and we're using it. We're still not doing surveys with it. What we're doing is developing protocols for doing sampling and surveys. So these survey protocol development cruises, there are two of them planned, one for mid-June and one for early July. And they'll be utilizing the new trawl gear that was developed by the advisory panel. These surveys that will take place in mid-June and July will last for approximately 23 days at sea. And the plan for the transition there is we'll have the Albatross through the fall of 2008. And then we'll be doing these protocol development cruises with the Bigelow this summer. And in September of 2007, the plan is to have both of our boats out there. The Albatross will be doing its typical groundfish survey, while the Bigelow will be doing a shadow survey of the Albatross. And all of that, the main purpose of all this is to get the Bigelow working to the point where we're comfortable with it as a replacement survey vessel, and also to get the data for estimating the calibration coefficients to link up what the new vessel catches versus what the Albatross catches. And that will allow us to make a link between the data that we've collected in the past and link it to the data that we'll be collecting in the future with the new vessel. And I don't want to sugarcoat this. We're all expecting a lot of growing pains, and the data that we'll collect on calibration coefficients will certainly be better for some species than others. And So in some cases, we may have a very smooth transition, and in others, we may have a lot of uncertainty for a while. And hopefully this uncertainty will go down as time proceeds and we're able to collect more data. Moving on to meetings, we had, for this vessel calibration work, we had a peer review meeting to get advice on the best approach for doing the calibration studies. So that meeting was held in Woods Hole from April the 25th to the 27th. And this independent peer review committee gave advice on how to spend the days at sea, whether to try to calibrate to one sweep or to using two sweeps in the future. And there's a short report that the panel has issued. And I can talk a little more about that later. There have also been, there's a fluke assessment update going on in Woods Hole this week on June the 19th and 20th. The track just took place in Halifax, and that was an assessment of the Georges Bank yellowtail, cod, and haddock. There was also as John mentioned, there's a benchmark stock assessment going on for monkfish, and we've convened two independent groups that are working with our scientists to do this monkfish assessment. And the first meeting was held from June the 12th to the 15th, and then the final meeting will occur in Woods Hole from July the 9th to the 12th. For sarks, we just had a sark in Woods Hole for northern shrimp and sea scallop. I don't have the final reports yet from the reviewers, so I won't be giving you a summary of the results at this meeting. But I expect to have those results available published by early August, and they'll be posted on our website for the saw sark. The sark in next fall has striped bass on it. And then we also have the garm, and there are a series of meetings coming up which all lead to the final garm meeting. So there will be a data methods meeting in Woods Hole from October the 22nd to the 26th. Then there'll be again in Woods Hole, a modeling meeting from February the 25th to the 29th. And that will be followed in late April by a biological reference point meeting. And then the final meeting for GARM-3 will be when the results for all 19 groundfish assessments are fully updated. And that will take place in Woods Hole from August the 4th to the 8th. And then we'll be producing a final report for release by September the 2nd of 2008. I think that is everything that I wanted to say. Thank you. I'll take questions.
Phil Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Jim. I have a couple of questions. First, as far as the Bigelow is concerned, in your handouts this morning, you'll see a thing that went to the trawl committee from Russ Brown. I just want to make the council aware that the preliminary, I guess you call it, cruise they went out on, they did 3 days of testing that. Basically, I don't think anybody in the committee even knew it was going to happen. Just, I think the time became available, so they went out and tested the gear a little bit, and it didn't function just like we hoped. In my mind, we got a serious problem. But that still has, you know, more testing has to be done. But from the results they put out the other day, when you take the gear overboard, it won't tend to the bottom with the roller sweep and stuff that's put on it. That configuration that they tested it with the other day, I'm pretty much dismayed with the preliminary results we've seen from this. And I think we got ourselves quite a problem coming at us considerably. That's my opinion. That's not the committee. We haven't met. I'm not sure where that's going to go. But my question to the center is, and I'm not sure if it's for Jim or Nancy, is the peer review that we had for the calibration they held the other day to do this calibration on the two sweeps. I've seen the report that they put out, and I asked Jim the other day, but I just really want it in front of this council. Has the center made a definitive decision on which way they're going, with the two sweeps or the single sweep? My understanding is, to me, it's a great big issue. My understanding is that there has been a decision, and yet the committee or the councils, I don't think, know about it. So I don't know if it's a Senate decision been made or not.
I'll let Jim fill in the specifics on that one as well, but a couple of things. First of all, the calibration of the vessels is obviously the highest priority that we're dealing with. Every time we go out, we bump into little kinds of problems. Some are bigger than others, but so far we've been extremely, in my view, successful in terms of working through them, which is the whole point of obviously taking it out and doing some shakedown before we even do the calibration, which is scheduled to begin in September. And I think we're also very fortunate that we've been able to convince the agency that we need to continue with that calibration through the entire calendar year of 2008 with anticipation of using the Bigelow in 2009. So again, compared to, I guess it's a, I mean, sure, nothing is perfect when it comes right off the shelf, but I have to tell you that, in my view, compared to the problems that the Dyson has had up in Alaska, the Bigelow has been performing extremely well. And you can't always anticipate problems, obviously. And so we've been able to work through, in my view, we've been able to successfully work through lots of these issues that have occurred. Obviously, we're open to input, but as far as the peer review is the working group is concerned, and the recommendations that came out of it relative to the sweeps, I have to admit I'm still learning what the difference is between the rock hopper and the cookie sweep. So I'll let Jim though talk about that specifically.
Okay, I actually don't know if the center has made a final decision on that, but what I do know is that the advice that we got from the peer review panel was very clear. And they said that what we should be doing, given the amount of time that we have, is to spend our time calibrating the roller gear, which is what we've been using, against the rock hopper gear. So it's just looking at getting a calibration of the existing gear to one other type of gear. And then they said that if it turns out that things go very well and we feel that we've collected enough data on the rockhopper gear, then to use that extra time to start to gather data on calibration with the cookie gear. But I think their message was very clear to just do the work for one sweep. And just read, they say that the panel reiterates that the calibration of Albatross to Bigelow with rockhopper is the highest priority.
Thanks again, Mr. Chairman. And that, Jim brings up, that's the understanding I got the other day. And my aspect, like I said, the committee hasn't met. My aspect of my view on it is, the committee recommended the two sweeps. And what Jim said needs to be taken in text, because the committee worked under the assumption from the day one that you're going to have over 2 years, close to 3 years, to calibrate this vessel against the other vessel. Guess what? The vessel ran a little late. Now, there's a big surprise, a boat coming late out of a shipyard. You know, but it did. It had some issues, whatever. The time schedule went up. They advanced the time a little bit on the Albatross, but we're down to where you're going to calibrate for right around a year instead of being two and a half. That's, to me, drives that decision on the sweep issue. If you're going to calibrate from one or two, it's driven by the amount of time that we have. And that's where we have a big issue, because as I tried to point out once before, by shortening this time frame of having the albatross available to the bigger load to do these calibration cruises, we're kind of stymieing the project here. To go to one sweep was not the recommendation ever put forth by the committee, to my knowledge. Gear was consistently designed right through the process with two sweeps, and now we're going to talk about one. So I'm myself very dismayed with where we are here right now. I mean, from what I'm hearing, the actual decision hasn't been made. And if you look at it in the text of just the peer review and the workshop and stuff, yeah, it's a scientific decision, and this is what it is. But you need to look at the bigger picture of why we're looking at that. And it's supposed to have been, we had supposed to have 2 years of calibration to do this, and our fearless leaders have shortchanged us. Thank you.
Just, Phil, would you explain what is a single sweep and what is a double sweep and why is that important? What do you mean by sweeps?
It's the bottom tendon part of the neck. It was designed for... One is what we call the rock hopper, which most of this industry, I mean, people around here are familiar with, is designed so it can go over some shady bottom, bounce along stuff. It's made with, I think, with, what's this, 12, 14, and 16 is this design we put on this year for the northern areas. That handles the Gulf of Maine, most of Georgia's. When you get below Georgia's, you can take every rock that's on the shelf between Nantucket and Hatteras and probably fit them in the back of this room. That's how much rock you're going to have to worry about in bad bottom. All the fishing that's done below that point is done with what they call a flat sweep, which is just a 3-inch cookie sweep. It's just rubber about that big, no real big bumpers or stuff. It tends the bottom considerably better. The design of this net is for that. The pre-test that went out the other day was done with the rock hopper on there. The biggest problem is you're not going to have the bottom tending capabilities in the southern areas on the stocks of concern. Mason, and that happens much more to the mid-Atlantic stocks, you know, to the issues down there. It addresses a lot of our issues, but a lot of it is the mid-Atlantic because they're index-driven.
So what the committee's recommending is that two different types of gear be evaluated with the Albatross and the Bigelow. Two different gears, meaning double sweep, and the service is looking at comparing one gear. Is that basically
that's correct?
It? Okay.
Yeah. And like I said, I understand the scientific reason for it, but you got to go back and look. The driving point here is we got shortchanged the year. You know, I mean, I'm sure that if the service had the other year, we'd be looking at it in a different aspect. And that's where the problem lies.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, Nancy, welcome. I haven't had a chance to meet you. I look forward to having some discussions with you regarding our involvement, the Division of Marine Fisheries' involvement with the center, maybe sometime during the course of the next few days. A comment and then a couple of questions. And the comment is that... Yes, Phil indicated there's some initial problems with the net tending bottom. I didn't realize that until he called our attention to this one pager in our that was on the table when we came in. A couple of references to disturbing news. Okay, that's fine enough. I expected there would be some disturbing news during the first try of this net, this new net with a new vessel. Frankly, the good news is that indeed, they were able to determine that which they determined. In other words, the net was not tending bottom. They were able to find out right away that it wasn't tending bottom properly in the deeper waters, which, of course, need to be sampled very well. And now they'll be working to correct that problem. I'm assuming the correction of that problem will occur during the protocol development cruises. That's my question. Is that going to happen mid-June? We're almost there. I guess we are at mid-June. Mid-June and early July, is that what's happening now, that as part of this protocol development process, you'll be making adjustments to the net and whatever else to make it tend bottom properly? That's one of the objectives?
Yes, I assume that's correct.
Okay, fine enough. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, and hopefully we'll have a report in the not-too-distant future that that problem's been worked out. Please, go ahead. Let that problem be worked out. All right. Now, you indicated, Jim, that there'll be a shadow cruise this fall, September 2007, of the Bigelow and the Albatross. Are we also going to have a shadow cruise in the spring, since the spring survey results are extremely critical for many of our assessments, notably the mid-Atlantic species? So are there any plans to have a shadow cruise in the spring as well?
Dave, I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to consult with Russ Brown. And the only thing I know for certain is what I told you in my report.
In that case, I would strongly urge, funds always being a problem, strongly urge that a shadow cruise do occur in the spring, because without that spring shadow cruise, I suspect there'll be almost no confidence in our ability to do any calibrations for scup and other species too. But scup comes to mind immediately, since we're so dependent on that, as well as dogfish. So got those two considerations at a minimum. And then finally, the track concluded. When do we expect to get a report of the results of the track?
I think the meeting just concluded last week, and I haven't seen any reports yet. I think that they post them on the DFO website when they're done. And I'm really not sure how long that takes, whether it's several weeks or more or less.
Tom Neese, did you want to add to that? You were at the meeting, right?
The Canadians expect to get the stock status reports posted within a couple weeks, and we will probably schedule a groundfish / TMGC meeting sometime in August, where we'll ask the Science Center to present those results to the Groundfish Committee in advance of the TMGC meeting.
Thanks, Tom. Next day, Rodney, and then back to Phil Rule.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Jim, if I may. At one point, we were talking, the committee was talking about having an industry boat compare both nets. We brought that up at one committee meeting. If there wasn't time, I was wondering if that option was still on the table. Both sweeps, I meant.
Yeah, that I don't know about that. I don't know whether it was dropped or considered or not. And I'd have to go back and read the review panel's report to see if that was discussed. But I don't know right now.
Okay, thank you. The other point is to the difference in sweeps, why the committee chose the two sweeps, was because the fall survey for fluke, winter survey, was always done with a cookie sweep, always done. And that's going to be eliminated. That's why we chose the two sweeps, because we wanted to capture the flatfish down in the mid-Atlantic. Using a rockhopper, that's why it's named a rockhopper, 40% of the time it's off the bottom. It's bouncing. Where the cookie sweep is not. And we figured we'd lose a lot of valuable information in mid-Atlantic if we didn't have the second sweep. That's why the committee chose that road. Thank you.
Chris Kellogg.
I'm not sure how clearly stated it is in the peer review report, but the peer review group did recommend going forward with looking at the cookie sweep. The problem was the one-year time interval. But it was important. They emphasized that looking at the cookie sweep should not be dropped, and that should continue after this initial calibration period. And Jimmy Rule felt very strongly that that should be in the recommendations, and indeed I think it's in the recommendations.
Right into that point.
Yeah, it's probably a choice of words. Looking and actually doing, to me, are two different things. having it done is one thing, and looking at it is something else. Thank you.
I have a question for either Rodney or Phil. The trawl committee is going to meet again, right? Do you have a date set?
We had talked about sometime in July. We haven't heard anything. I haven't heard anything as of that. The handout did you have here this morning? I think Jimmy was scheduled to go on to Bigelow, and Rodney's scheduled to go out and try and assist in tuning the gear and what have you for the first few days. Then there were some other members that might go. I don't know if I'll go or not. But the committee itself, I don't think, is meeting again maybe in July, which is a whole host of other issues we need to talk about at some time, because there's a lot of things this committee set out to do never been touched yet. And that's a big issue with me, and I brought it up in the committee. I think at the next meeting we're supposed to be discussing some of that. But I just want to emphasize what Rodney's saying here. That's why I raised my hand, is under the plans that I've seen so far, the winter survey disappears this year. I think it's this year. It'd be the last time they do a winter survey. The winter survey was put in probably 10 years ago. It's designed with a flat sweep for the Mid-Atlantic area. And that's going away. So, you're going to increase the spring survey and the fall survey, I think, by a 10-day period or something like that on each one. So it'll make a little longer for those two surveys. Do away with the winter survey. But at the same time, right now, we're saying do away with the flat sweep, and that's going to be a real big problem.
What, we'll get into this later, but what did the Mid-Atlantic Council have to say about this? It sounds like the gear that they depend on to sample the species that they manage is the gear that's not going to be calibrated under the current your current understanding. So I would assume that the Mid-Atlantic Council would want to weigh in on this. Rodney.
I wasn't at the Mid-Atlantic Council, but that's not correct to say that the Mid-Atlantic depends on the flat sweep. We have a lot of northern boats that depend on that survey also. The fluke fishery, Massachusetts, Rhode Island boats, we have the squid boats. So I think it's a joint from both councils. So, but I don't know
exactly.
The
species managed by the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, it's managed by.
That's what I said,
okay.
The species managed by the Mid-Atlantic.
Okay. The other thing is I don't know. I wasn't at the Mid-Atlantic meeting.
Okay. Well, I'm going to suggest it's obvious that there's concern. The two members of our council that are part of this committee are continue to be concerned. You've brought these concerns to the council over the past two meetings. So hopefully you can get somewhere if you do have a July meeting. But I plan on talking to Pete Jensen, the chair of the Mid-Atlantic Council, as well to see what we can do. As you said, Phil, the reason this whole thing got mucked up was because the timeline has been constrained, and it seems like that's always an issue. Timelines shrink and dollars shrink as well. Hopefully the Trawl Survey Committee can put together some sort of an alternative plan or work with the center to get the most out of what's available. Dr. Pierce?
I'm hoping that the center can work with the committee to indeed find some way in which the trawls testing can be done with the sweep, the cookie sweep. The reason why I say that is we've mentioned fluke, but, of course, yellowtail flounder, southern New England, Georges Bank, Gulf of Maine, those are the stocks. That's the species that seems to command so much of our attention, the stocks that are in need of most rebuilding. We did a cod industry, cod and a yellowtail flounder industry-based survey. April, to my right, she was in charge of the yellowtail industry-based survey done in cooperation with the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, and it was very clear that that survey had to be done with the cookie sweeps. It was done with cookie sweeps. Therefore, if we go with now roller gear, the concern that Rodney expressed will certainly intensify as time goes on and we find ourselves potentially not adequately sampling the yellowtail flounder that are out there. And we know they can be very well sampled through the cod IBS, the yellowtail flounder IBS work that got good marks from the peer review. So, again, just a point to raise. This is extremely important as we get deeper into, as we get closer to 2009 and beyond in our need to, meet these biomass targets.
John Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll just throw in a couple of cents here. Listening to this discussion, the real issue that seems to come to mind is for some reason, there doesn't seem to be communication between the working group, which was put together to help deal with the new vessel and the calibrations. If that continues, you know, I've seen it many, many times. If there's no credibility out there, then we're going to be dealing with problem after problem because nobody's going to believe the data coming out of the surveys. That is not acceptable. We put this group together to help. Whatever needs to be done as far as communication to make sure that everyone's well informed on the rationale of why things are being done. And I'm not saying which way it should go. I'm just saying that the communication needs to be there. In my sense is it's not, and that'll lead to a credibility problem, and that's a problem for the whole council.
Agreed. Nancy.
Yeah, thank you. Where do I start? Obviously, the decision about what the gear are going to be used relative to calibration comes to me. The group was put together. We had a review of that, and we're following the recommendations that came out of that peer review. Again, in an ideal world, we'd have more time and we'd have more opportunities to evaluate everything that's being used. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, your approach in terms of working with the center, because that's what it is going to take. And to a certain extent, obviously the decisions are a function of the amount of time that is available as far as the calibration is concerned. And yeah, initially we went forward to the agency and said that we needed minimally 2 years and optimally 3 years to do the calibration. And of course that requires a considerable amount of funding. I mean, the funding that's necessary to do this full calibration is well over $2 million for the period of time that we have available to us, which is about 14, 15, 16 months, something like that. So basically at this point, you know, we're following the recommendations that came out of that peer review. They are based on, you know, the best scientific advice. I understand that there are compromises and there are, you know, things that probably are occurring that not everybody is happy with, but that's basically where we are. And I'm happy to work with the council if there's a way that we can move forward, you know, and make some progress relative to some of these compromises that have had to be made.
Okay, Phil, you started this. You get the last word.
Try this once more time. I tried it last time and didn't do a very good job, but I still think it would be a good idea for this council in mid to send a letter to the Admiral requesting that they reevaluate the time that they allow the Albatross to stay on, that it is a big issue, and we could do a whole lot better job if they would put her on for another year.
Unless there's a disagreement, that's what I plan to talk to Pete Jensen about. Is there any objection to that? Okay. I'll do that. Jim, anything else? Okay. Mid-Atlantic liaisons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Mid met twice since we last met. And, let's see. The first time they met was in Ocean City, Maryland, April 17th, 18th, and 19th. On day one, they had four committee meetings. There was the research set aside, the ecosystems, their protected resources, and the squid mackerel butterfish. At the ecosystems committee was kind of interesting, and it might be to some folks on this council. They had to deal with special management zones, which is a little strange because bottom line is these were reefs that were built off of New York and New Jersey to attract fish that were kind of like man-made reefs. And now there's a big move to not allow fishing on the reefs. So that's what they're dealing with on that issue. That's, I mean, not allow certain types of fishing, let me rephrase that, on these reefs. Next, the Protected Resources Committee met, and they were dealing with the sea turtle issue in the ANPR that came out in February. And I just put it in here because it might be something we want to keep our eye on, because there was comments made at the committee meeting and the council meeting. The ANPR says they want to move the turtle, the TED line, what they call, for having a turtle excluder device northward, which right now I think is at the Virginia-Carolina line, and they're proposing to move it further north. They haven't said how far further north, but they're going to move it further north. And was a couple of recommendations that it be moved to the Hague line. So we might want to keep a real good eye on this one. I don't know how serious that was, but there was recommendations to move it to the Hague line. The SQB committee met following that, continued developing alternatives for Amendment 11, which is the limited access mackerel fishery amendment. Major concern, most of the discussion there was the herring bycatch in the mackerel fishery and how to handle it. Because, as you know, we had a little disagreement on the herring process. So that was about that. The next day started with the executive committee meeting, and then followed by a presentation by Dr. Powell from Rutgers University and the NFI Scientific Monitoring Committee on some of their RSA projects. And I asked to have included in your briefing book one of these projects that I thought might be of interest to some folks on this council. And it deals with the bag limit and fluke and how that, the effects of that bag limit. Now, it's one report, it's just it for informational purposes, but I found it kind of interesting. Later on, L.A. came down and she held the public hearing for our EFH amendment. And then they moved on to summer flounder scup black sea bass, which was the second meeting for the Framework 7. And what this Framework 7 does is allow changes to the planned biological reference points through the spec-setting process. So that last year with that whole fluke issue and stuff, they now have they're clean that up so they can adjust the BRPs in the spec-setting process with a lot of criteria. It's not quite... There's a certain amount of criteria that goes with it that, you know, you would assume it'd be there is there. Next, they reviewed the cost recovery program and the search plan motion cohog plan and made some recommendations on that. Then they passed a motion in the mackerel, under the mackerel report, to form an industry advisory group, which you talked about before. Just to deal with transboundary issues. That was pretty much wound up that one. The next meeting was held last week in Hampton, Virginia. Day one started off with five committee meetings: research set aside, ecosystems, enforcement, SQB, and the executive committee. RSA just discussed issues to went over program and the performance issues and some of the projects and way to improve it a little bit. And the ecosystem committee had a presentation that we were asked about here. It was taking the bait presentation that went out with some interesting discussion. Then the law enforcement committee met, and it wasn't a very long meeting, but they discussed the congressional hearings that were held on fishing vessel safety and having some council input into that, to these hearings and into this upcoming legislation, which I think we should probably be keeping track of. The SQB committee reviewed the monitoring committee recommendations for the 2008 quota setting process, and I'm not going to read off all of the specs, but they're in the motion package that's handed out here this morning. By the way, everything else is behind tab 14, I think. They set the specs for squid, Lalago squid, Ilex squid, mackerel, and butterfish. A little later on that day, we council went in. Council adopted the specs after that for the site plan motion Quahog process for 2008. They're also in the motions. And then go back to the SQP report at the council, and the specs were set for, like I said, 2008. What's interesting there is there'll now be a, to some folks up here anyhow, is a butterfish trip limit is now, will be in effect next year, which is like a 5,000-pound trip limit on butterfish for the year with a cutout. And the next day started with a presentation by Dr. John Borman with the status of the Recreational Data Collection Initiative, which we're going to need to be seeing at some point how they're going about this data collection and starting down that process. It's quite the undertaking. Following that, we went into tilefish, something that we sit on. We do have a city on that committee, and I didn't get to the last meeting, but the Amendment 1 is an ITQ amendment that's they just approved the public hearing document that's coming out. So I did ask them to have one hearing in southern New England area if it was possible. We used to have, in southern New England, had quite a few boats in the tilefish fishery in the early 80s, and they kind of got disenfranchised or moved on and not fishing in that fishery anymore. But what I found really interesting is the proposal and the alternatives pick out three different time frames for the ITQ plan to go forward. The earliest being, I mean, you can go back as far as 1988 in time for your landings data is the one scenario which any of the southern New England boats don't fit into. Well, very few of the southern New England boats that used to participate will ever fit into that prior to, you know, they all fished prior to 88. And I mention this because last year, a year and a half ago, we got a letter from the Mid on Heron asking us to go back to 84. So that's where we are with this one. I did ask them to have it here in southern New England and hope people might show up and talk about it. Next, council handled the SBRM amendment. That bounced around for a little while, and at the end of the day, they voted to go forward. And last but not least, an industry member came to the microphone who had requested his history, and I happen to know this fella and can speak to his credibility. He requested his history from the service database because they were looking at forming squid sectors, so he just looked at a partial of his history. And he's a fairly big player in the squid fishery. And he got his history back, and he started reviewing it, and he found major discrepancies. And he reported it to the council the other day, and what we might want to keep an eye on. He reported his discrepancies, which is in the millions of pounds. He had other fisheries. He's had some problems there. So, I mean, I must say the service was not really aware of it, and I'm sure they've taken actions for it. But there was eight fishermen in the audience. Four or five of them came to the microphone reporting the same thing. They had major discrepancies with this data, with data that they received. The other few hadn't requested their history, so they didn't know. But it's just something that we might want to keep an eye on. And that was about it. Thanks. Pat Kirkle.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Actually, we've been in touch with that individual, and at this point the discrepancies are in the thousands of pounds going back about 10 or 12 years or more. And so from our perspective, are fairly minor, although certainly we want to know about any discrepancies in the information. And at this point, it looks like it was maybe a miscoding between Illex and Lalago,
But for the most part, as I said, they seem to be minor. We're going through them with them, and anybody else that has a problem, we want to know about it, and we want to see if there's some sort of pattern here. But doesn't seem to be the major problem that was reported at the last meeting.
Anyone else? Okay. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. Happy to report since we last met, there's been no losses of life at sea in the fishing industry. So no matter what else happened, it was a good period. We worked 25 SAR cases, so that's still about one every 4 days where we're out getting an injured person off or towing a boat or dewatering a boat as things goes on. One vessel ran aground. It's a great illustration of the fishing industry. It's a perfectly good boat, perfectly good rudder, perfectly good engine. Somebody fell asleep, and the boat ran aground. And fatigue is still a huge problem out there, safety-wise. Five vessels were reported taken on water, and two of them eventually sank. The causes are unknown, but we were happy to get everybody off of those two boats. But again, two boats sank. Dockside safety training, we were pleased to participate with the Massachusetts Fishermen's Partnership in two events, one in New Bedford and one in Gloucester. About 140 fishermen came and participated with us. I'd ask the council's help in talking those up when we get the money to do those again. Inside of 1 day, a fisherman gets a tremendous training bang for the buck. Inside of 1 day, get some hands-on firefighting. Hands-on survival skills, actually firing off flares. You know, we all have flares on the boats, but who's actually fired them? And that's the kind of stuff you want to know how to do before you are faced with an emergency situation. People get to get into a pool and put their own survival suits on, and there's some shocking lessons they learn sometimes, particularly if they've got old survival suits, and they realize that maybe what they just bought from their buddy wasn't going to save their life, and they're going to have to go out and put some money into a real piece of gear. And they get a helicopter orientation. We were able to bring helicopters to both of those events so people could see what a rescue basket was going to look like before they might have to get into one. And that's all inside of a day. And the Massachusetts Fishermen Partnership finds the money for it, so it's free. Pretty hard to object to. The dockside safety examinations, we conducted 646 dockside safety exams. And of those 646 that we conducted, we issued 168 decals. So that's a little under 25% folks achieving that sticker when they come in the first time to get their safety exam. So it just shows you how much faith we put in those exams. We don't give those stickers away. The boat's got to be in good shape to get it, and only about 25% of the boats coming in are achieving it on the first time. Enforcement of safety at sea, you know, in our boardings this period, we found 43 safety violations and had to terminate the voyage of six vessels this period for substantial safety violations. Enforcing fisheries at sea, there were six gear violations. Three vessels were improperly declared or fishing in the wrong area. Two vessels were fishing in closed areas. One was an unpermitted vessel. Two vessels had expired permits, and three vessels had illegal catch on board. Phil Rule had asked at a previous meeting to see some compliance rates, and I think do we have a slide for that? Pretty high-tech slide there, huh? When you're done digesting it, what it tells you is for at-sea boardings over the last 5 years, we've got a fisheries compliance rate of about 95%. And that's for active fisheries things like gear, okay? If you get all the way into the administrative compliance and the safety compliance, then we're down to about 80% of the boats are found fully compliant. But for fisheries law, it's about 95% we're getting on average. And so congratulations and thanks to the industry for an excellent compliance rate in at-sea boardings. And lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about the 75-25 rule. Not because we have any new initiatives on it, but because it's shown up in the newspaper reporting that we do have a new initiatives. 75-25 rule refers to the citizenship requirements upon U.S. vessels and upon U.S. fishing vessels. And so, just briefly, the master of the vessel has to be a U.S. citizen, period. The master of any U.S. vessel has to be a U.S. citizen, including fishing vessels, right? For the crew, now not counting the master, for the rest of the crew, it's called 75-25. 75 have to be residents, 25 can be non-residents. Counting towards the 75% are people who are resident aliens. Okay? So a lot of confusion there, I think, a lot of people trying to figure out, you know, gee, I've been in the country, I've been fishing for 12 years, I'm a resident alien, what does the 75-25 rule mean to me? It means you can still go fishing. For most of the council, there's a paper on the 75-25 rule, and there's also, if anybody in the audience wants to see it, there's one on the back table there. It sort of explains it, and shit gives you a little more technical information on it. It's not that complicated, and there's also a website referred to in this paper that you can go to if you have any more questions on it. And that's all I've got, so thank you. I'll take any questions if there are any.
Dave Gable.
Yes, thank you for this citizenship requirement fact sheet. I'd just like to make a statement on the record that this is a major problem in the industry. Last time I placed a help wanted ad, I got 20 responses. They were people that shouldn't even be on the street, never mind on a boat. You know, they had mental health issues, substance abuse issues. Some thought it was an apartment to rent. Americans, it's getting increasingly difficult to find Americans to work on boats, especially in the groundfish fleet under the restrictions we're under. The second problem we have is the fact that it's pretty hard to meet a 75-25 rule when you're a two-man boat. It can't be done. So the fact is that this is a serious safety issue. There are a lot of boats now fishing with just a master and no crew because they can't find an American to work, and they can't find somebody with a green card that fulfills the 75-25 rule. There are a lot of people wandering around with those work visas that would love to work, but you can't take them unless you meet this waiver process, which, quite frankly, the fishing season would be over before that waiver process was granted. I mean, that's just an incredibly regulatory nightmare. So that's my statement, and my question is, with this immigration bill going through Congress now, has the Coast Guard addressed this issue with Congress, and is there any possibility of changing this from 75-25 to 50-50 so that two-man boats could hire somebody?
I guess two questions. Have we addressed it with Congress? No. It's Department of Labor. It's kind of out of our lane a little bit, but we certainly can look at helping you communicate the issues that you're worried about. There is a waiver process. If you have to go through your state Department of Labor to go to the federal Department of Labor to show that there are no U.S. citizens available to go to work for you. This ultimately came out of the Jones Act cabotage law, which is pure. I mean, the design of that law is protection of American jobs. So if there are no Americans left to work, I think you need to be documenting those efforts that you're taking to find Americans, documenting the results of them, and going to work to get the regulations changed.
Rodney?
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to thank the Coast Guard for assisting in these safety trainings. They've been an excellent partner. We have almost 800 fishermen that have gone through that between New Bedford and the partnership. I just want to emphasize that we should be pushing that, even for follow-ups, because I took two of those safety trainings, one in 2005 and one in 2006, and I thought I was a cat's meow. I thought I knew everything. First thing I would have done was blown up my raft, because the flares have changed since the last time I was there. When I was oriented with flares years ago, it was a handheld flare or a smoke parachute flare. Now they're almost like shooting off a shotgun. That's one of the first things I observed. The second thing was we had about 60% of our the people that came through New Bedford, survival suit failures. Some of them was a little bit as a zipper was stuck or a little leakage. Just because you have a survival suit, you think that's your emergency kit, it doesn't work. I just bought three on one of my boats, and all three of those failed. They were less than 2 years old. So we should be encouraging this, and a great job to the Coast Guard. They've been an excellent partner. Thank you.
Thanks, Rodney. Jimmy?
Yes, I've got a question. On the two boats that sunk and the other two or three boats that took on water, do you happen to know the age of those vessels?
None of them were new. I mean, if what you're getting at is the average age in the fleet now, I think, is 31 years old. And there used to be old rules of thumb, particularly for steel boats. 30 was not a good birthday for a steel boat, and that's the average age in the fleet now. So, I don't have an exact age, but they were old.
Anyone else? Paul Howard.
Just a take-home message on the 95% compliance rate can be mixed depending on how you look at it. I don't want it to get an oversight that, you know, 5% still non-compliance can cause havoc in our industry. And, and especially where we're, you know, operating on the margin with a lot of our stocks on rebuilding, that 5% can be significant. So I don't want anyone to think that we need less enforcement based on a 95% compliance rate. We'll be looking towards needing more enforcement as we get to different management schemes. I just want to make that.
Okay. NIMS enforcement. Sorry, April, did you have a comment? I'm sorry.
Actually, I did, but I can wait till after. It has to do with enforcement, so I can wait.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everyone. Andy Cohen, Special Agent in Charge of the Northeast Enforcement Division. I'm going to be very, very brief because during the Enforcement Committee report, we're going to be giving a VMS presentation, so I'm not going to address anything having to do with VMS during this report. I've given you all the council report of enforcement activities, and I can answer questions on that if you have any. I wanted to make you aware of one continuing problem. I think at our last meeting, I told you about a series of events, where farm-raised catfish from Vietnam was being imported into the United States through Laos to avoid tariffs and treated with an illegal antifungal called Malachite Green. Several millions of pounds made it to the United States. Several weeks ago, we indicted, I believe, seven individuals concurrently with Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents and the FDA. And the indictment took place in California because that's where the original import took place. So we had a little more leverage using California as the venue for charging. However, a great deal of that product came to the United States, to the East Coast of the United States, to Virginia, through New York, and to Miami, and it was being marketed as snapper, grouper, and yellowtail flounder. And I think the lesson is that illegal imports of aquaculture-raised products that are mislabeled is a real threat to domestic fisheries and markets. We're now developing intelligence regarding sea scallops being farm-raised in China. And frankly, the laws that we have to work with on that are not the strongest laws, and we're going to be creative and keep an eye on this. But I wanted to make you aware that I think that this continues to be a growing threat to domestic fisheries and the whole fishing industry. That being said, last week We arrested three of the defendants in California. One was not arrested, and an additional guy was permitted to self-report to the arraignment. So I will keep you posted in the future. That concludes the non-VMS portion of my report, so I'll be happy to take questions.
April?
Yeah. The graph that you threw up before with a 95% compliance rate, and Paul made a good point to that about what about the other 5%. And just looking at this enforcement report, I'm looking at here on some repeat violators, some of them in my backyard going back to the 80s. And even though they've been fined or had permit sanctions, this and that, they keep resurfacing. And what mechanism is there to stop that? I mean, I see in here there's one that I can think of three other times that he had major violations, didn't pay, whatever, resurfaced another boat somewhere else, and he did the same thing this time around, didn't pay, so now he's suspended indefinitely. But at what point do these repeat violators, what's a backstop to keep them from coming back into the fishery?
That's a really good question, and it's a timely question, because it's part of an ongoing conversation and debate between the Office of Law Enforcement and General Counsel and the Department of Justice. The short answer is currently, under the Magnuson Act, civil remedies are the rule. We can assess, or no General Counsel, can assess monetary penalties. We can get an interim action to get people out of the fishery. We can sanction their permits or revoke their permits. And in the cases that you're referencing, I don't know specifically why permits were not revoked and people were put out of the fishery permanently, but we can talk on the side and I can find out the rest of the story on those individuals. One of the versions of the Magnuson reauthorization had criminal penalties, criminal sanctions for repeat offenders. That version of the bill did not make it. So we still do not have the option of taking a habitual offender and charging them criminally under Magnuson. General counsel feels that in the case of repeat offenders, the civil remedy is severe enough to deter the behavior. However, as you can see, it doesn't always work that way. But we are... We're doing the best with the tools that Congress has given us.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy, you said that the catfish, that Vietnamese catfish had been treated with malachite green. Did that trigger any additional sanctions from FDA? Did this rise to the level of a criminal offense?
Oh, yes. FDA has charged that portion of the case. It is a criminal offense. We charged it under the Lacey Act, which is illegal imports and Lacey Act marking regulations. We charged it as a conspiracy, which is a real hook. Some ancillary charges like wire fraud and mail fraud. So there is no civil component to that case. It's all criminal. And the Office of Law Enforcement had to spend better than $500,000 to store the product because, of course, it couldn't be entered into commerce because of the malachite green. We just got permission from the court to dispose of it, and it will have to be incinerated, and that may cost another $1 million. It's a very expensive process.
Dave Cathel.
Yeah, I kind of a follow-on question to April's question about violations here. I noticed the Coast Guard, in their report, said that they had several people were found in closed areas without permits, without VMS, from what I can see, without anything. I mean, if you're going to violate the law, no sense, you may as well just violate everything. And I'm just curious, do you and the Coast Guard have a plan to continue to surveil the closed areas to look for people that are,
it isn't a VMS infraction because they don't have one of them. Why have one? Then it tells them you're out there. I'm still concerned that we have people that would you know, basically enter these areas with every intent of breaking every law there is, and the only way to catch them is to have people out there in some fashion. So is there still that presence available?
There most definitely is. The Coast Guard and OLE meet 4 times a year to discuss strategies. As a matter of fact, we had a quarterly meeting yesterday morning. We coordinate efforts. We call them pulse operations. We do that in concert with our state partners and other agencies. The Coast Guard provides the platforms along with some of the states, and we do as much of that surveillance as we can. And we try not to do it randomly. We try to act on good intelligence. And frankly, a lot of the good intelligence comes from folks like you who can point us in the right direction, because the industry is the eyes and ears, and we rely very heavily on that kind of feedback from the industry. Now, the captain did show you some impressive compliance rates. I just want to point out that in this quarter, we seized $276,000 worth of product, and NOAA General Counsel assessed penalties of just about $80,000. So compliance may be good. I would submit that it's still a target-rich environment, and I think that's what you're telling me, Dave. Any assistance that you can give us in focusing our efforts in the right place will be taken very seriously and appreciated.
Anyone else? Joe?
If on an average day, all intelligence aside, there's a medium endurance cutter, 3 patrol boats, and 3 overflights going out looking at living marine resources throughout the district. So we use the new tools like VMS, but we're still sticking with the old tools too, like presence. Presence, we still think is a big one.
Phil?
Just one quick question, Andy. Of the $276,000 assessment, what do you usually, do you have a number of what you recover out of that?
I don't know the current ratio. That's a good question for NOAA General Counsel. As I've said before, I'm always reluctant to get too far into the weeds in the penalty phase or the collection phase, because there's a natural conflict of interest, and that's why law enforcement is separate from prosecution. But it's a good question, and I would refer you to one of the General Counsel attorneys. I'm not referring to Gene Martin. I'm referring to Chuck Julian's group. Gene is not an enforcement litigation attorney.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, our final report, Vince O'Shea, ASMSC.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Sorry I haven't been here since you became the chairman, but I don't have anything specifically to report. Other than to say that our commission met in May in Alexandria, Virginia. The report of that meeting has been out. It's been covered in the press, and it's posted on our website. Our next meeting is in Alexandria, Virginia in August, the middle of August. And as always, our meetings are open to the public. So I'm happy to be up here, Mr. Chairman. I'll be here through Thursday. Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. When we come back, we'll have a presentation.
Voted on by industry before the secretary can accept and approve the